Welcome to The Workplace, a podcast by Cal Chamber. I'm Alan Zarenberg, President and CEO of the California Chamber of Commerce. Joining me on the podcast today is Dr. Richard Moshishki, who is the Executive Vice President of Science and Regulatory Advocacy and the Chief Medical Officer at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, PhRMA, as most people realize that. Dr. Moshishki has a history with the FDA and is very familiar with all that is happening with testing, treatments, and vaccines related to COVID-19. So, doctor, thank you for joining us today and being able to talk to our audience about what's going on in the world of testing, treatments, and vaccines. And I know that we've seen Congress put together a pretty good fiscal stimulus package to help workers and employers, and we've seen the Federal Reserve Bank put together a pretty significant monetary policy. But in my opinion, these are bridges until we can get our economy back to somewhat normal again. And that really, in my opinion, is going to turn on science and the aspects of whether or not testing will be more available and more ubiquitous, whether that will help. And then also, of course, treatments, whether or not we can reduce the time in hospitals, whether we can avoid people having to go to hospitals if they do incur this virus. And finally, is vaccines the ultimate answer here? And where are we on that track? So if that's the right order, doctor, a short term versus medium term versus long term, maybe you can just start right off a little bit about how you see the science and everything going on with all your member companies that are working to help solve this problem throughout the world.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. Glad to be here and to talk about these issues, despite the fact that we're in this very unfortunate situation of a pandemic in which we have to talk about these issues. It's an unprecedented time. Certainly for businesses, I can only imagine, but it certainly is for the pharmaceutical industry right now. They are working night and day to try and find the answers that you have laid out actually very well. I think on the first front, you're right, we're going to need effective therapeutic agents, treatments, things that can help patients survive once they have the more severe aspects of this. We have to identify those patients with good diagnostics that are readily available to those who should be tested. And then we need to have another bridge approach. And that bridge approach can be a different kind of treatment using antibodies that can help protect high-risk patients until we finally have effective and safe vaccines ready for use for the general population. I couldn't agree with you more that the way that we move this forward is with science.
So, doctor, we hear and we read that there are different kinds of research going on testing, some to expand what we know is testing today, but there's also discussions about whether or not we can make testing more available, doesn't require a medical professional to accomplish the test. Are those things doable? Are they on the horizon, or are they part of a longer-term solution?
No, you're absolutely right, Alan. I think the only question is the timeline by which we can actually see enough of these tests being made available. But all of those things technologically are being developed right as we speak. So, you know, I think the early tests that we were dealing with were essentially sort of artisanal or, you know, done by laboratory personnel by hand using a technology called PCR, which allows you to identify the genetic material of the virus. As you know, we early on had to deal with a few hiccups from the test that was being developed here in the U.S. by the CDC and then used by state laboratories. And of course, the personnel and the amount of materials available for tests were woefully short in supply. And so testing was, in fact, pretty difficult to obtain, except in very specific circumstances. Mm-hmm. I think once industry gets involved, it does change the game. One of the things that industry does extremely well is to move into the mass production capability of industry, and also to use technologies that can highly automate the process of testing. For example, both Abbott Laboratories and Roche Laboratories have high throughput instruments that are in hospital laboratories today, and have adopted testing so that these high throughput machines can actually be used to conduct the testing. And that is now available and being manufactured by thousands of kits getting out there. And I think that's was an initial game changer. But I think what we're also going to see soon, and the timing is different, right? So, you know, initially we know that it was taking days for people to get answers. And now with these new, more rapid technologies in place, you know, I know FDA has already approved some of these that can give answers in 45 minutes, and then another one in 15 minutes has been developed. And so, you know, that time interval is greatly reduced. The numbers are greatly increased for the availability of tests. And indeed, I think the next tests that I know actually are in play, but still need some work on gearing up their availability, is point of care testing, so that a doctor right in his office can do the test and get you a result, or a nurse. And then finally, we do know that people are gearing up for tests that could even be done in the home setting. Now, some of these tests, of course, the initial tests were very much aimed at identifying the presence of the virus, as I said. And so those kind of tests tell us where the virus is. What's also coming online now is telling us tests that tell us where the virus has been. And those are blood tests as opposed to, you know, swabs of your nasal passage where we're looking for the virus. In this case, with the blood test, we're looking for the after effects of a virus, which occur when you've had the infection, your immune system responds and makes antibodies against the virus. And these antibodies are very specific. So you don't have these antibodies unless you've been exposed to the virus. And this is also extremely important for us as we try to get America back to work, because it's not only going to tell us about the patterns of how the virus is spread, when we look at the data that will be accumulated from these blood tests. But it also allows us to say who is likely to be protected and who can be in a situation where they might be able to be re-exposed to the virus without coming to harm because they've been immunized naturally.
So, Doctor, in terms of practical application, I mean, I certainly see at least two benefits from the testing. One, of course, as you pointed out, to be able to identify, so I'll use the word communities where we may see this more prevalent than others and focus our resources there. Also view it as use my own language here, as an alternative to mitigating the risk, an alternative to social distancing, how we can mitigate the risk, because we know who may be exposed to this and who hasn't been. And, you know, today when I was at the grocery store, before the workers came in, the management was testing their forehead with a thermometer because that's all they have. I assume that's not fail safe. That only indicates who is actually sick, not necessarily who's a carrier. Can you see a future where businesses can test their workers and make the workplace safer for them as well as for their customers?
I think that's a possible future. I don't think we're there yet. We don't quite yet have that kind of testing access, but we can get there. You know, as far as taking your temperature, I know that that's been done on many fronts. That could turn out to be terribly misleading. You know, we now know something that we didn't know a few months ago. We know today that the virus is often spread extensively before people get sick. They can transfer the virus in their respiratory droplets, and they're not even coughing or sneezing or feverish yet.
That's very good information, I think, for people who are, you know, looking for that silver bullet, and it doesn't necessarily exist in just taking somebody's temperature.
Yes. So I think if we have point of care testing where you could come into the factory and you get a pinprick or a swab of your nose for that day, and someone can rapidly process that and wait for a few minutes and then bing, come back and say, we do not detect virus in you today. So you're free to go into work versus someone who turns positive and is sent home. I think that's a future possibility as all of the testing technology is really being developed.
And the pharmaceutical companies are working exactly on that type of a test and test results. Am I correct in that right now? They're working on it.
Yes. I mean, as I said, you know, there's high throughput capabilities, point of care capabilities, and potentially even home testing, which could either be done at home or, of course, in a sort of a commercial setting.
So moving on for a little bit to the treatment aspect, I mean, you know, there's also discussion about whether or not, you know, people can build up immunities in the community. And as you said, to test for antibodies, doesn't that certainly make a lot more sense if you're able to have better treatments that are going to reduce the risk of long-term and expensive hospitalization for people who do eventually become ill from the coronavirus?
Well, I think it makes a huge difference. I mean, right now we know that there is, unfortunately, a very significant degree of mortality associated with COVID-19. And that is what frightens us all, and that is what is keeping us at home. But if, in fact, we knew we had very effective medications to treat you and greatly reduce the risk of dying from COVID-19 if you do get it, that obviously changes the game again. You know, that makes a big difference for us all, and particularly if, you know, these agents can help avoid having to use a ventilator and avoid the more severe stages of the disease. Or if you do get those severe stages of the disease, help you through them quickly and get you off that ventilator and back to good health much sooner. I do believe we're making great progress in that direction. I suspect we'll never have a magic bullet that will automatically cure you, but I think we seem to have indication that we will have agents that are going to mitigate this significantly.
Do you think these will come from existing medicines that we have, or that we will, you know, your companies will be developing new treatments that will reduce the risk of hospitalization?
Yeah, so Alan, I think the answer is D, all of the above. And, you know, there are over 300 clinical trials going on in the world today on treatments for COVID-19. More than half of those are using agents that are already available and on the market. Some of the more interesting ones of those are agents that have been developed for other viruses, such as anti-HIV antibodies. There's also an interesting agent that from Japan that is a flu treatment that in the laboratory has shown effects against coronavirus. And so that's being studied now also in clinical trials. And so these are agents that actually exist already today. And then, you know, there's a group of agents that have been developed but not yet approved for another disease. And I think the case in point here, and maybe the most interesting of them, is remdesivir, a drug by Gilead there in California. And this was a drug that was being developed for Ebola as an antiviral agent. And while the data was not so great around Ebola, it did show very good activity in the laboratory against coronavirus. I know that we have all heard just recently of some of the early experience in an uncontrolled initial use of the drug, uncontrolled meaning that there was no comparison group, but it was used in patients who were extremely ill in that group of that was reported out recently in about somewhere around 50, 60 patients. And about 60% of those patients or more, maybe 67%, if I remember correctly, did well. And these were patients who we would have expected to do much worse. So we do think we're going to get a readout soon, probably maybe by the end of this month, on controlled trials with remdesivir. And if those are positive, we could see FDA rush through an approval for that drug, and that drug could be available potentially even sometime this summer.
Wow. So just to conclude on testing and treatments, it sounds like this certainly, because vaccines are, we're going to say, a little longer term, we'll get to in a minute, the strategy is more ubiquitous testing, make it easier in the short term. And then if there is a chance, I mean, this, I think, for a lot of industries, of course, who depend on congregations, you know, the convention business, Disneyland, certainly sporting events, whether or not the risk isn't as great if you have an appropriate treatment that applies to most people. And so maybe you can just touch briefly as we get into vaccines. Are the companies working together? Is this unprecedented? Is the government helping to pay for this? Is this something that universities are working on with your companies? How does this all come together? I mean, we hear stories that you're working around the clock. There are many scientists and professionals at the pharmaceutical companies. How is this all coming together, and who's pulling it together?
So it's coming together in many, many different ways. In my long career in biopharmaceuticals research and development, I've never seen anything like this. You know, and it's truly so heartwarming to see how industry has responded. People are not so much interested in patents or IP or this or that, but to get something out as quick as possible. And in order to do that, companies are working together in consortiums and collaborating with each other. They're talking about, they're sharing their data, talking about how to even more quickly and readily share the data from their early experiments. They are talking about sharing data from their clinical trials, and they are talking about sharing their molecular libraries. These are compounds that have been created over years and years that companies have, and they can then take those compounds and rapidly screen them to develop new treatments for coronavirus. They are themselves screening their existing compounds they think might have promise for a variety of reasons, and then sharing that information. It's quite astounding. And so, you know, they're throwing the usual way of doing things out the window in order to work together and cross those company lines to find the best agent in the quickest way possible, and to move them through clinical trials. I think this might be the largest use of a new type of clinical trial called platform trials or master protocols, in which you have one group of patients who serve as the control for multiple different treatments that are going to be tested all within the same sort of clinical trial. You know, even in getting compounds out and creating these compounds, I think, represents years of investment by industry. Initially, you know, a lot of our science that allows us to attack coronavirus comes from the same virology that was marshaled to fight HIV. Subsequently, for conquering hepatitis C, and then was also used and sharpened further in trying to develop agents for MERS and SARS, other coronaviruses like that had occurred in the past. And also, industry's been investing in technologies that are now fully coming to bear in the pandemic setting. Some of these technologies are really quite exciting. One of them, in fact, was called the Pandemic Preparedness Platform. And in this, you can take from a patient who had recovered from coronavirus and take blood cells that were involved in making antibodies against the coronavirus. You can take genetic material out of those, put them into other cells that you grow in the laboratory, and get those cells to make these antibodies, and then select the very best antibodies that are produced from that kind of mechanism to have very highly effective antibodies that can be administered to people who are either actively sick or who are at very high risk for getting sick. Now, one of the important things about these antibodies is that they can be a bridge until we have a vaccine.
That's a great lead-in to a discussion about vaccines and whether or not these antibodies are going to be used for treatment and they mitigate the risk and the consequences, or are we talking about long-term actually eliminating the COVID-19 consequences completely? And many years ago, there was a disease in America called polio that had severe consequences. And that's, people don't know about that because you did have a vaccine that was developed by Dr. Salk that basically eliminated polio. Can we look forward to that? And what kind of work is being done here? And I think that's a great lead into your discussion on vaccines.
Yes, I agree. So antibodies are just the bridge. They can be used in the meantime for very high-risk patients. So, for example, you might give these antibodies to people in nursing homes who are at very high risk. And, you know, one infusion of an antibody could protect them for a month until they can get their next infusion. But vaccines are the real answer and the best answer, because from, you know, one injection or one oral application or maybe a few series of applications of the vaccine, you will have long-lasting protection. But one of the most important things that I think you are getting at, Alan, is what's called herd immunity. When we get vaccinated, not only are we protecting ourselves, but we're protecting each other. And so if you are one person who's vaccinated in a group of 10 people, the other nine who are not vaccinated and who develop the disease, then your chance of getting that disease is still maybe present, even if you only have a 10% chance because you were vaccinated, or maybe a 5% chance that you'll get the disease because you were vaccinated. But just think about it, if all 10 of you are vaccinated and all 10 of you have a significant protection, then the chance that any one of you will get it is even much less. So vaccines give us that opportunity to create the herd immunity that has happened with polio, as you point out, where, you know, the polio virus has nowhere to hide. It has no one to infect and stay alive to infect the next person. And that is one of the game-changing issues that will occur when we have a safe and effective vaccine.
So to finish that up, with all the work that's being done on vaccines, obviously it takes trials and to make sure that there aren't consequences to the vaccine that are worse than the actual disease itself. Is that a year process? Is that shorter, longer?
It's longer. It's certainly longer than what I think we will need to understand whether therapeutic agents work. Because there you're dealing with sick people and either they get better or they don't, and you can compare very quickly. But with vaccines, it's a much more longer process. You know, in fact, you know, Tony Fauci himself has often talked about that if you look back even just a few years ago, from the time you identified a virus to the time you created a vaccine for that virus, could take as much as 20 months just to have something to put into clinical trials. Now, with today's technologies that we have developed in industry, we were actually able, from the January when the coronavirus genetic makeup was published, we could in 2 months have a potential vaccine ready for testing, which is just an amazing difference. But then let's get into the testing, the human testing itself. So the vaccines, you have to, is different than a therapeutic because it's being given to healthy people, right? That's the point of the vaccine. Whereas the therapeutic, you're giving to someone who's already sick, and there the risk benefit is different. So you really want to know and have some significant degree of experience with a vaccine before you start giving it to healthy people. So you start out with phase one trials to first look at initial safety. Then you get into these phase one, two, or two trials where you look for the immune response. You want to show that, in fact, when you immunize, you are getting an immune response, you know, that you're making antibodies, and that you're making antibodies directed against the right virus, and that you can show that those antibodies can inactivate the virus in the laboratory. But then the bigger issue is that you need data from thousands of people to make sure that you don't have any sort of rare side effects from the vaccine. And you need to have a sizable enough experience that when you can tell the difference between people who've been vaccinated and whether they get infected or whether they get less symptoms or more symptoms when they do get infected in comparison to people who weren't vaccinated. And those much larger trials and longer trials, because it takes a while to have enough people exposed to begin to see a difference in the value of that vaccine. So what are we talking about here? Well, I think if everything goes really, really well, you know, some of these early vaccines that are already in clinical trials, and there's about six vaccines, I believe, that are now in clinical trials already, then we might have something within a year. We might even have something by next spring as a very safe and effective agent.
Well, Doctor, notwithstanding the fact that that's pretty unprecedented, I think the business people who are out there looking for more normalcy, their hope is really about testing and treatment in the short term or midterm. And with the vaccine, which sounds unprecedented to be a year away, but still at least a year away for widespread use, we have an opportunity here that the research is being done 24 hours a day to find better testing that can be more widespread. And that sounds like a key component here. And then the treatment, if somebody is exposed, we can reduce the risk of severe illness or death by having the appropriate treatment. And that sounds like there's a lot of work being done that has, based in our conversation here, that is hopeful.
Oh, it's very hopeful. I think this kind of unprecedented use of science, collaboration, cooperation, partnership with government agencies. For example, the FDA has been fantastic in working with the companies to help move things along. I believe you have laid out the roadmap for very significant hope on all of these fronts and all of these tools.
Well, Doctor, so much thank you for being with us and being part of this discussion today. And I think one of the things that we can take away from this is that the hard work being done by many scientists throughout the world that are part of the Pharmaceutical Research Association is going to lead to our economic recovery. And we may not have a vaccine in the short term, but it sounds like we're on the path to being able to mitigate the risk from COVID-19.
I believe so. It will take a little bit of time, but science is how we get back to normal.
Thank you, Doctor. Thanks for joining us on The Workplace. Stay up to date on the most critical issues for employers during the COVID-19 crisis, and comment, share, and subscribe to Cal Chambers podcast by visiting calchamber.com.